I'm Mark Pimenta, the host of the Warlords of History podcast, exploring the lifetimes of warriors, leaders, ancient and medieval, who were titans during their respective ages. Also delving into the surrounding environmental and political conditions, their motivations for taking on the mantle of war, and what their legacy was beyond their demise. If any of this interests you, join me as we dive into each of their lifetimes, their worlds, in the Warlords of History podcast.
Okay, hi everyone. Welcome to Ancient Heroes. I am here today with Anthony Caldelis, who is a professor of classics at the University of Chicago with an expertise in the Byzantine Empire. He's the author of The New Roman Empire, A History of Byzantium, which came out late last year. Hi, Anthony. It's great to have you on.
Thank you for inviting me, Patrick.
I think first off, I'd like to hear a little bit more about you and your background and how you came to have this expertise in Byzantine history.
Sure, though it's not a particularly exciting story. I was planning on specializing in physics and biology when I went to college at the University of Michigan. The American college system allowed me to explore other topics, and I developed intellectual interests in philosophy and history, mostly ancient philosophy and all periods of history. But eventually, I gravitated toward the medieval Eastern Roman Empire or Byzantium for a number of reasons. One of them is that it was relatively underexplored and understudied at the time. This was in the 90s. And also because it, as a culture, it contained many of the elements that I found to be interesting in the study of world history and just a history of thought. Including Roman and Greek and Christian traditions, kind of all mixed together in an interesting way. And I was interested in those traditions regardless of period. I mean, whether in antiquity, and I've always been in a classics department and teach classics courses, whether ancient Greek language courses or just general classics culture and literature, or in early modern thought and down to today. In other words, you know, how those traditions continue to, you know, shape modern thought and society and so on. Byzantium is my academic expertise. It is the area in which one specializes to publish, right? So it's not my only intellectual interest, but it's the one in which I'm a sort of academic expert.
Okay.
And that's what attracted me to it. I don't think that what I just said now can explain how I turned from physics and biology to those kinds of fields. Suffice it to say that the way in which they were taught to me in Greece, where I grew up and went to school, was, say, not ideal. And in the American college system exposed me to them in a more interesting way, and I was drawn to them in that context. So I continue to believe in the ability of teachers and universities, especially the more kind of open system of an American university, to inspire and attract students to those fields.
Mm. So you were born in Greece, or were you born in the United States?
I was born and raised in Greece, yes.
Oh, wow. Okay. My wife and I did a road trip through Greece, or at least part of Greece, a couple of years ago, and it was incredible. We started in Athens and went north to see Delphi, and we went to the Pelion area for a couple of days and stayed there, and then ended up in Thessaloniki for a few days. Yep. And it was just, it was incredible. Anyways, I can't wait to go back. We only scratched the surface, but we didn't get to any of the islands or the Peloponnese and all this. But what was it like growing up there?
Oh, that's a whole other podcast. we can talk about that. Sure. I was very lucky. I had a privileged, you know, sort of stable sort of family life. Went to a good school and you know, no real problems. It's like a water slide, but also nothing particularly interesting either. The one thing I will say about Greece, sort of picking up from your description of your trip there is that it is it's sort of remarkably densely packed with history and culture, such that, you know, probably with a higher density of that than any other place, in the sense that in a relatively small area, you have like Bronze Age and Classical and Roman and Byzantine and early Christian, right? And then you also have early modern and Ottoman and so forth. And it's all just packed in together in a single place. And you don't have to travel enormously long distances to get from one, you know, major site of interest to another. And it's something similar that happens with the Greek language, especially ancient Greek, which is, well, it's hard enough, you know, to learn depending on what your native language is. For me, again, it wasn't, I mean, it's hard. It's hard for everybody, especially the medieval stuff that I study. But it's certainly easier for someone whose native language is Greek, so myself. So, I mean, I'm kind of half cheating, you know, in that sense. But it is a language that, you know, once you learn it, such an incredible field of literature and writing is open to you, from ranging from, you know, Homer down to, well, as late as you want to take it. You know, modern Greek requires some extra training and some, you know, you have to learn that as a kind of almost different language from ancient Greek. But ancient Greek continues to be written down to the, you know, 15th, 16th, 17th, 18th century, depending. I mean, people are still keeping it up. Mm. So this is thousands of years of writing and history and literature that open up to you just by learning that language. And then you learn the different variants. Yeah, there are, even in antiquity and in the Middle Ages. So again, for the effort of learning one language, you get quite a bit of sort of punch in there. The same thing for going to visiting Greece. It's one country. It's a relatively small one. Actually, technically, it's average size, but whatever. you get a lot of history packed in here. Yeah.
Yeah, that was definitely our experience. I want to come back to what you said about the Byzantine Empire being relatively understudied. As a kind of a lay person, you know, I grew up learning some about, you know, classical Greece and Rome and stuff like that, but very little, almost nothing, I would say, about the Byzantine Empire. And it's all a little bit new to me. So why do you think that's the case, that it is kind of understudied and not as well known, at least to Americans, as what we think of as the Roman Empire, Julius Caesar, Augustus Caesar, this kind of, you know, the Roman Empire of Gladiator and that kind of the way it's depicted.
Right. Well, there are lots of reasons for that, but as in every country, American students and the American educational system will focus on the periods of history and the cultures that are assumed to be most relevant to Americans. And classical Greece is, because of the way in which a certain narrative about sort of Western civilization has been constructed. It's a very constructed narrative. You can construct a different one, but that's the one that we have. And ancient Greece has a role in that, and ancient Rome has a role in that, but the medieval Eastern Roman Empire does not. The Byzantine Empire, the Ottoman Empire does not, the Holy Roman Empire does not. And so you don't learn about those because there's no real sort of direct line of, you know, whether political continuity, ethnic, linguistic, you know, whatever. The lines of genealogy have been drawn that way, such that, you know, people who talk about the West today or Europe or whatever you want to call it, selectively choose this culture and that culture to be part of that story and the others to not be part of it. Hmm. So that's one reason. Another one has to do with the odd role that the Byzantine Empire plays in European thought, which is not a good role. It's generally been treated as what happens when things go wrong, right? In like the Enlightenment tradition, from which the United States springs, right? So like the foundation of the United States is an act of like political enlightenment in some respects. Enlightenment thinkers tended to use Byzantium as a kind of an example of what happens when political systems become despotic, like in the same King George was, what happens when Christianity becomes sort of intolerant and superstitious and persecuting, which is precisely what kind of Enlightenment thinkers are trying to get away from. You know, what happens when even cultures and languages degenerate and they believe that, you know, later Greek and later literature had lost all of its, quote, vigor or spirit or whatever it is. And so they gravitated toward the more, robustly kind of nationalist literatures of Greece and Rome at their, quote, peak. And so anyway, there are all of these kinds of considerations that played a role in that. And Byzantium got left holding all of those negative associations, and we're trying to dig our way out of the hole right now. And in a certain sense, my history that you referred to is part of that process, just trying to shake all of that burden off and tell the story of the society in a more accurate way.
Hmm. Can you give us a little context for myself, but also I'm sure a lot of listeners, of what is Byzantium? I mean, just the basics, where, what time period are we talking about? Just kind of the fundamentals, so we can kind of get a sense of what we're talking about.
Sure. The first thing to realize is that there's no such thing as the Byzantine Empire, or the Byzantines has never existed. It is a modern fiction. What we are talking about is the eastern half of the Roman Empire, the ancient Roman Empire. Your readers will have heard of, your audience will have heard of the fall of the Western Empire. So they need to know, if they don't already, that this is a misnomer. Only half of the ancient Roman Empire fell in the 5th century AD. The other half carried on, for some time, doing quite well for a couple centuries. And then it began to lose territories to the Arab invasions and so forth. But it continued on without any, you know, significant political break in its institutions and traditions and culture and sort of language and religion and so forth for 1,000 years almost after the fall of the Western Empire. And so it really doesn't fall until 1453 when the Ottomans conquer Constantinople. So that is 1,000 years later. So what we are talking about is the history of the East Roman state and its society, which begins by spanning, let's say, the Balkans, Turkey, Syria, Palestine, and Egypt, so the entire Eastern Mediterranean. You know, territories fluctuate from time to time. Then in the middle period, we're really talking about parts of the Balkans, sometimes a little, sometimes a lot, and Asia Minor, so that is modern Turkey. And then after that, in the later period, it begins to contract pretty dramatically. And we're talking about some just territories in the modern Balkans and Greece until it's just Constantinople left. And in 1453, that falls too. So that's what we're talking about. It's primarily a Greek-speaking society, much more so after the 7th century. It's overwhelmingly Greek-speaking. It's a Christian society, especially after the 6th century. Its version of Christianity is what today we call Orthodoxy, like the Greek Orthodox Church, right? And it is a Roman society. That is, it not only its political structures, institutions, and laws, but also the basic identity of the people in it was Roman. So Byzantium is just it was an alternative archaic name for the city of Constantinople. That's all it was. In the 19th century, it got repurposed by European scholars as a name by which to refer to the whole state and its entire history and its people. But it is a bit of a misnomer, and it's a word that kind of serves as a vehicle to perpetuate these prejudices that I talked about earlier. In no European language did the word Byzantine mean anything good around 1900 when it began to be used as a name of an academic discipline. It always meant something bad. In Italy, it referred to the dysfunctions of the Italian bureaucracy. You know, in English, spoken English, Byzantine refers to something super complex, devious, convoluted, and even malicious, and so forth. So it is a very problematic term to use because of those associations. But I hope I've given a sense of the sort of where we are in time and place, and what the main cultural components of this society were.
Absolutely. I think the surprising thing to me about all of this is what you said about 1,000 years. I mean, to have this empire, this civilization existing for 1,000 years, but to, as a layperson, for it to have such a, for it to be so dwarfed by what I think people think of as, I guess, the Western Roman Empire or the Roman Empire at its so-called height, is just very surprising. Can you tell us a little bit about Constantinople and the role that it played? And I'm curious, was it already a major hub before the fall of Rome itself in the Western Roman Empire? Or did it then be, I mean, kind of what was its trajectory and role in all this?
So Constantinople was founded on the site of an ancient Greek city called Byzantium or Byzantium. It was a probably mid to small sized town, probably specializing in the export of fish from the Bosporus. The fishing in the Bosporus has unfortunately now died out, but it was a major source of fish. And it was not a particularly important city in its own right, but it was in a very strategic location in the sense that Roman imperial civil wars tended to be fought around it because it's precisely at the point, it's at like where modern Istanbul is, right? So it's precisely at the point where Europe meets Asia, and it was on the European side, but very close to Asia. So any imperial power that wants to control both, you know, the parts of both of those continents has to control the straits of the Bosporus. And so it was a very important strategic point. Which was one of the reasons why Constantine, early 4th century, decided to dramatically expand the city and make it into a New Rome, which was one of its official names, Constantinople and New Rome. And pretty soon it began to function as the imperial capital of the Eastern Roman Empire, though there was no sort of official division between the two halves of the Roman Empire. But in practical terms, by that point, the empire couldn't be ruled by a single ruler. There was usually two, sometimes four, sometimes five. And if they got along, they kind of shared the powers and the territories among themselves in a sort of ad hoc kind of way. There wasn't formal divisions. It then became the administrative capital of the Eastern Empire. That is the place where all the hierarchies culminated, right? So that's where the high military command was. That's where the church was sort of headquartered in the Patriarch of Constantinople and the Holy Synod that met there. That was a committee of bishops from other parts of the empire advising the Patriarch, the tax system, the legal system, and so forth. So it became a real capital in all bureaucratic and administrative senses. But it was also a highly fortified place. The walls of Constantinople are just on a different level. So these walls were built in the early 5th century by the Theodosian dynasty. So they're called the Theodosian walls. And the land walls withstood every attack by foreign invaders down to the Ottoman Turks, 1453, who had cannons. So, okay, that's a different... You've entered a different era at that point. The sea walls around the parts of the city that adjoined the sea were less impressive. They're still very impressive, a bit less impressive. They had been breached by the Venetians in the Fourth Crusade, so 1203 and 1204. But they had ships that could, you know, land marines on the walls and, you know, crazy stuff like that. Keeping the capital safe from attack was one of the factors behind the longevity of the state that you mentioned. In other words, if an enemy couldn't take the capital, it was very difficult to conquer the empire. And there were many times when enemies approached from east and west, and they kind of faltered at the Bosporus or the walls of Constantinople. That was one factor. There were very, very many more. I don't believe that this was the most important one, but you're right to draw attention to it.
Was during the medieval period, were there other cities or capitals on par with Constantinople? I only ask because I think the perception sometimes of the medieval period is that it was a decline of these great ancient cities, and it was people wandering through countrysides and fiefdoms and castles and stuff like that. But you didn't have the Romes and the Alexandrias and these things. They weren't at their, they had declined, I guess. So what was the role of Constantinople in the kind of the medieval world? And were there other cities on that level?
Well, what you described is more true of Western Europe. Okay. So the part of the Roman Empire that did fall and was replaced by a number of, quote, barbarian kingdoms, and definitely the economies contract, the demographic economic scale of things was significantly reduced, the quality of life in some ways, certainly urban environments declined, many cities, you know, either their populations contracted significantly and so forth. So what you described characterizes Western Europe. It does not characterize the Eastern Roman Empire. That just simply didn't happen. This was a highly, it was administrated society in the sense of there were land censuses, efficient taxation, a monetary economy. There weren't just people randomly wandering about. Like, everybody was integrated into the structures of governance, whether they be military, fiscal, legal, and so forth. It was a very interconnected society. It was probably the most sort of bureaucratized and regulated Christian society of the Middle Ages. It was not until much, much later. In fact, probably not until the early modern period that Western European countries, like we recognize, like France and England and so forth, were able to operate on that scale of bureaucratic sophistication. Probably 16th, 17th century, you know, that they managed to attain that again. So Constantinople was on just a different level compared to anything else in the Christian world. But the Christian world is not the only world. There were other cities in the world at that time that were as impressive, if not more. So, for example, Baghdad, a century or two after it was founded, was larger and probably much more impressive in its own ways. And there were other cities that at times became very important. Much later on, Cairo was huge. And going further east, to China and so forth. So there were big cities and even bigger cities, but in the Christian world, for sure, it was the most impressive. And you have to imagine the impression that it made on visitors from, say, Scandinavia, who had possibly never seen more than 40 or 50 people at one time, or even from England, like Anglo-Saxon England, where nothing was built in stone for a very long time. In fact, the very word in Old English for building is from the word timber, ye timbre, it's just like wood. And they arrive in Constantinople, and it's a city of hundreds of thousands of people. I mean, depending on the period, the population varies, obviously. But, you know, these with Hagia Sophia and like four-story flats. And I mean, it's just, it's on a different level.
How much of medieval Constantinople is still intact or can still be seen if someone visits Istanbul?
Not much. I mean, there's enough to justify going, by all means, if you have that opportunity. Read up on it first, so that you know what you're seeing and you can prioritize, because obviously, there's more to see than just the Byzantine remains in Constantinople. There's also a lot of Ottoman buildings, much better preserved. And there's also modern Turkey, which is an enormous modern city with some fascinating neighborhoods and a lot of things to do and see. Though in parts that are not in the enclosed space of the medieval city by the walls, it's like further out north and on the other side of the Bosporus and so forth. The modern city is just enormous, like 20 million people or something. there is enough to justify going. There's some major monuments, obviously Hagia Sophia and the land walls and many of the cisterns where they stored water and many other churches. But the truth is that many of the sort of secular attractions, things like the Hippodrome and palaces and roads and imperial columns and things like that, don't survive that well. There's a bias in favor of the preservation of religious buildings for one reason or another. Many of them were turned into mosques during the Ottoman period, and so they were, you know, maintained and survived. Whereas the Ottoman authorities had no reason to preserve the secular infrastructure, and so it decayed or was used as a quarry, simply just removing materials from there to build the things that they wanted to build.
Yeah. Interesting. I have to ask, it's a bit of an aside, but are you familiar with the novel Cloud Cuckoo Land by Anthony Doerr? Have you heard of this?
Yes.
Okay. Because there's quite a lengthy aspect of the book that's about the Constantinople and the fall of Constantinople. Yes. And I thought you might enjoy it.
I remember picking it up a few years ago. Just a few. To be honest, I didn't make it through the whole book. I can't remember why now. It just wasn't my cup of tea.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure it was on your radar in case no one had mentioned it to you, because it put the whole Constantinople thing on my radar and it made me more interested in the subject. But it is an odd book in some ways.
There are many novels written about the siege and fall of Constantinople in 1453.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. I didn't know. I had no idea. Okay. Well, can I ask you about the government? You mentioned that to some extent it was a continuation of the Roman Empire. Was there an emperor of the Byzantine Empire? Was it that kind of monarchy? And how did that work? Okay.
Yeah. If you're familiar with how the ancient Roman Empire operated, this one is not going to be tremendously surprising in how it operated. There was an emperor who was the direct institutional descendant of the ancient Roman emperor. They're called Augustus sometimes, just to show you a sense of continuity. However, at some point, the culture and the operations of the government, this took a very long time to happen, switched over from Latin and Greek into Greek only. And so the name for the emperor became Vasileus, which had originally meant king in Greek, but was repurposed now to refer to the imperial position. Now, mind you, the ancient Roman emperors don't have a fixed title. So from like Augustus to whenever, there isn't one title that means Roman emperor. Caesar might be one word. Augustus might be one word. Imperator was used sometimes. Didn't mean emperor, though. There are all kinds of terms. So it took a while for the position, as it were, to become kind of fixed within the political system, because the whole point of it in the beginning was to avoid it being anything, right? Like Augustus was sort of trying to pretend for a while that he wasn't some new thing, but a kind of combination of a bunch of old things. And so they didn't give it a label. Eventually it became sort of more crystallized in that sense. And so the ruler was called the Vasileus, or if you want to translate it as emperor of the Romans, Vasileus non Roman. So very straightforward. And he appointed governors and he appointed generals, and there was a Senate. The Senate didn't function exactly as the ancient Senate, certainly not the way it did in the Republican period, when it was like essentially a kind of governing body of state in some ways. Not even the way it functioned under the Julio-Claudians, where it was a kind of partly adversarial, partly supportive, independent body. It gradually became absorbed by the monarchy into a single governmental structure. So the Senate was mostly a body consisting of the highest officials and former officials, and basically just people who had senatorial rank. And they advised the emperor and performed all kinds of roles. Very often when an emperor died without an heir, the Senate would appoint a successor.
Okay. So when I was reading a little bit about your book, one of the things I came across was that you're helping make a case that the Byzantine government, the monarchy, I don't know, whatever institutions of government were less oppressive and autocratic maybe than people thought. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So one of the main ways in which Byzantium was tarred and feathered in the European tradition was being labeled as a despotic, like an Oriental despotism. And this is a form of government in the Western European imagination in which a kind of absolute ruler sort of dictates, you know, how his subjects are going to live and what they're going to do. And they have to simply obey. And so the population has been stripped of all kinds of political virtues and the ability to, you know, make decisions in any meaningful way. And the ruler is an autocrat who just dictates terms from on high, supported by an ideology of divine favor. This image was useful in the context of Enlightenment thought, in the kind of sense that even if it had never really existed in practice, it would have to be invented as a kind of ideal type, like good to think with in a certain way. And Byzantium, in addition to some other regimes, got sort of branded that way as the alleged historical example of that sort of thing. We now know that that's not how it operated. And I'm not saying anything particularly original. I mean, my colleagues will recognize this. The monarchy was very much in conversation and in negotiation with multiple or several different constituencies in the body politic, ranging from the army to the bureaucracy to the court to the population of the city to the church, the clergy, and the general population. And that because emperors were not, let me put it differently, there was no law of succession, there was no right to the throne, no one could claim to, to be the sole legitimate heir and only possible heir because of, say, family succession or, any other mechanism such as an election or anything like that. It was all very ad hoc and pragmatic. Of the 91 emperors that we have during this millennium, 40% came to power through some sort of violence, that is by overthrowing their predecessor. That's a high number, higher than in most regimes. That the structure of the regime otherwise remained the same. In other words, there was never a revolutionary attempt to change the structure of government. What you have instead is an endless series of coups, assassinations, and very brief civil wars to replace the person at the top. That is all. And so since emperors were sort of vulnerable and insecure all the time, looking over their shoulder, they had to, or most of them decided that, they had to be popular and to be seen as virtuous and responsive to the needs of their subjects. And sort of champions of orthodoxy and so forth. Meanwhile, on the side, they were buying political support from various parties who might either be potential threats or who would be necessary for sort of broadcasting the virtues of the regime. So it was a very tricky situation to be in, emperor. It was not like you sit back on the throne and enjoy the perks of the office. No. This is very, very hardworking and very, very insecure. Insecurity, of course, made some rulers paranoid, obviously. But paranoia would very quickly make you unpopular. And when you become unpopular, then there are all possible rivals who are looking at you and thinking, well, I can replace this guy, right? And so you have, like about 100 civil wars or something like this. It was in the interest of the monarchy to project benevolence toward its subjects, and a number of features. And these are what I highlight in the book. And you find these in the laws. You find this in the administrative enactments. You find this actually in the way the government behaves. In other words, it actually behaves, for the most part, in the way that it says that it would behave, which is to take sort of proactive measures on behalf of the welfare of its subjects, to be accountable, in other words, to create laws and mechanisms by which subjects can bring complaints against abusive officials, to hold its officials to account, but also to make sure that its subjects sort of knew that the taxes it was collecting from them very efficiently, there's a census here, were being spent for its benefit. Now, most of the expenses went to the army, whose purpose was to defend, well, the entirety of the territory, not just locally. However the high command determined the priorities at any given moment. So emperors are saying, you know, you pay taxes, we pay the soldiers protect you. I mean, is that kind of reminding the people all the time? So this is what I hope will be a new model for understanding how this society worked. It's not a kind of autocratic despot at the top who's just, oppressing his population on the one hand. It's not a set of sort of cynical elites who are running the government like a kind of plutocracy just for their own benefit. And they're like aloof in the capital, living the good life while squeezing the provincials. This is a model that some scholars still hold to. I don't think that's correct. There is no fixed aristocratic elite in Constantinople. The government elite at any time are people drawn from the provinces. They're very much in touch with the provinces at all times. And their interests are linked to the provinces. It is rather one of this much more negotiated sense of trying to preserve the regime's popularity so that we don't have another one of those episodes like we had 5 years ago.
Yeah. Well, it's one of the most fascinating points I've heard, what you were just talking about, that, you know, you would think, of course, the possibility of coups and assassinations and things like that would create so much instability that it would be bad for any civilization, any empire. But it sounds like there was a level of accountability to the rulers that this created, that it wasn't just okay, you're the son of so-and-so or whatever, so you're next regardless of what happens, or, you know, so that's right. An absolutely fascinating dynamic. I wonder on the individual side with the Byzantium, I mean, obviously the way many of us think about history is through the lens of these larger than life historical figures, the Platos, the Alexander the Greats, the Julius Caesars, Cleopatras, et cetera. I know we can't, I'm sure there's a whole host of characters from Byzantium, and we obviously don't have time to get into all of them, but is there anyone that comes to mind while you were writing the book or that you've been fascinated by that you wanted to bring to the forefront, or maybe listeners would be curious to read more about?
But the short answer would be no, and no on principle. In other words, I don't think that during this entire period there was anyone who was larger than life. It is a category into which I would probably put very, very few people in all of world history, and hardly any of them would be sort of statesmen, politicians, or generals. They would almost all be philosophers or scientists or something like that. So the goal of my book, almost a programmatic goal of this book, is to make this society and this civilization intelligible, sort of understandable in a certain way, that while we can't psychologize every person and every ruler or know exactly why they did the things that they did, obviously we can't do that. And I try to avoid psychologizing as much as possible. In fact, I hope entirely. At least we can understand the parameters in which they were making decisions and why they might have thought that those decisions made sense and for whom, and right, and under their circumstances. So the book is written in such a way as to give you the circumstances, give you the context, tell you what people were doing, in such a way as you will understand. Well, okay, I guess that made sense in context, even if perhaps it didn't turn out well. And so none of these people were, in fact, larger than life. There were some who tried to make themselves seem that way. Probably the one who came closest to impressing me was emperor in the 12th century, Manuel Comnenus, Manuel Comnenus, who it was just part of his politics and his international diplomacy to make himself look that way. You know, if you look at him closely, he appears to be very much a life-sized human figure. It's just a particularly charismatic one and an able one, with his flaws and failures, you know, just like any human being has. But I think he's the one who probably did the most to make himself seem that way to contemporaries. And he did. It worked for the most part. It's just that within a few decades after his death, for various reasons, the polity was falling apart. The wheels was coming off and the Fourth Crusade came off and you enter this massive crisis. And so he appears in history right on the precipice. And so it's difficult to see him in the way in which he would have wanted to be seen. But otherwise, I just wanted the readers to be able to see these people within their context. I don't think there's any one of them who would have impressed me that much in person. And I say this about like almost all of history. There are very few people I would be seriously in awe of personally, if like Homer. Okay. but these are also kind of people we don't know very much about. We just have, you know, Homer's poems. They are mind-blowing to me.
Yeah.
And there are certain things, you know, from the Byzantine period that are seriously impressive to me. Like, for example, Hagia Sophia. That was put together by a number of people. If you tell me, like, who would you like to meet? I would like to meet those people in a room and ask them a bunch of questions. Yes.
Okay.
I would be seriously impressed by what they did. Like, yes.
That's a great answer. I think about that kind of thing a lot. You know, any studying history, reading about history, to what extent are exceptional individuals the thing to focus on versus, you know, the context, as you said, and this is obviously an ongoing debate and there's different ways to look at things. I think my human brain sometimes fixates on individuals, but I don't know how much of that is really legitimate versus just, it's easier to think about a charismatic individual and it's more entertaining in some ways to read about that person than, you know, a broader, you know, civilizational movement or, you know, sociological sort of thing. It's hard to think about climate change because it's on such a broad scale,
right?
But it's easy to think about individual politicians and to argue about that.
You're exactly right, and I think this is a very important point, and you know, we should bring it out. I think we need to keep reminding people that we live in highly complex societies. Even medieval societies are sufficiently complex in their structures that they can't be reduced to just individual personalities. I mean, this is something that obviously happens a lot in fiction, you know, be it novels and movies and so on, because the kinds of dramas that those genres tell, and they're very important for human beings to have those dramas. I'm not putting them down, but when we're thinking as historians, and especially as trained historians, we have to prioritize the historical workings of complex institutions that are interacting with each other in sometimes unpredictable ways. But we do have to keep all of those balls, juggling them in the air, because we, first of all, want to understand those societies. You know, you mentioned climate change. That's exactly right. This is a very complex problem, and we do have to solve it and get it right and as well as we can. And to do that, we simply cannot fall back on sort of individual human choices. This is something that, for example, the polluting industries want us to do. They want us to think that solving this problem is a matter of individual choices and that, oh, you know, we're not doing as well as we could. That's, you know, it's because you didn't recycle enough or you didn't buy an EV or you didn't cut down on. No. There are very big structures in the economy and technology and industry that are just way beyond any individual consumer to make personal choices and do anything about. This requires structural change. And so you have to understand those structures. And, you know, some players in this situation don't want us to understand those structures, be that as it may. In the medieval context, there's no one preventing us from understanding how these things work. Right. They're not as complex as they are today. They are complex to a certain degree. But I think it's the job of professional historians to try to make those structures and their interplay somewhat more intelligible. That's what I try to do.
How much of the book covers the fall, let's say, of Byzantium and then the legacy of Byzantium? Are those things you get into in the book?
Not that much. So I had to make some decisions about distribution of coverage. Mm. And I decided that I would weigh the book by, let's say, sort of population and territory. In other words, periods in which there are simply more people living in this state, like toward the beginning, when there's, you know, more parts of the world, more cultures, more languages, tended to get somewhat more attention in my coverage than the later ones. And there's a real difference in scale here. So I just thought it's just not right to give it the same amount of attention to a state with, let's say, 30 million people and five major languages as I did to toward the end, where we're talking about a state that has maybe 250,000 and one major language. Like it's just not, you know. So I slanted it a little bit toward the early period, then again toward the middle period when it expands again, the later middle period. And it does become more, the narrative does gallop a little bit more toward the end. Now, keep in mind that in the later period, it becomes significantly more complex in terms of the international scene. Hmm. When we start, there hardly is an international scene very much. There's Rome, there's Persia, there's some barbarians, and they don't have like really developed states or whatever at this point. By the 14th and 15th century, it's like as complex an international scene as today.
Yeah.
In fact, more complex, because you don't have sort of very stable nation states with defined borders and laws and treaties. And you have like just moments of real, real chaos. And so I had to give some sort of sense of like, who are all these, you know, Turkish emirates and crusading monastic orders and the papacy, and there's Normans and there's whatever, you know, and there's Bulgaria and there's Serbia and there's, okay. So it gets much more complex. And to do full justice to that would require another book of that size. So I tried to kind of delineate the context, but it is a much more complex context to talk about a rapidly dwindling state of like a few hundred thousand people. And so, which is like a suburb of Athens.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, I want to remind listeners that I've been talking to Anthony Kaldelis about his book, The New Roman Empire, A History of Byzantium. Anthony, is there anything major that we haven't covered that you wanted to mention?
Oh, there's a lot. so one other theme of the book is the evolution of the Orthodox tradition. Because there's a joke, which is how many Orthodox priests does it take to change a light bulb? And the answer is change. What change?
Okay. That's,
There's a bit of a trope in Orthodoxy that it is a very conservative tradition that sort of doesn't change very easily or quickly. And nevertheless, over the course of this millennium, what was understood as proper Christianity in the East changed quite a bit. And it changed both for internal reasons, but also under pressure from the outside. And, you know, this is how you get from early Christianity before Constantine, which is like a sort of persecuted, very small minority religion in the empire, to something very much resembling modern Orthodox identity, which is, at a vast remove from where it started. And so I'm trying to trace all of the steps of that story, through narrative, but also through analysis. So that's another major theme of the work.
And that's something, again, being in America, growing up Catholic and that kind of thing, I just know virtually nothing about Orthodox church and stuff like that. So that's a whole another element of this that maybe we can do another episode sometime about. Sure. Well, Anthony, is there any place you want to point listeners to find your work? Obviously your book is available online, but a website or social media or anything like that, that you would want to point people to?
Sure. No, I don't do social media, but occasionally I interview colleagues who are working on various aspects, more technical sometimes of the field. And so there's a podcast called Byzantium and Friends where they can go and listen to that if they want to delve into some of, more technical, particular or esoteric aspects of this long, long history. There are about 120 episodes there by now.
Awesome. That sounds great. I think our listenership's a good mixture of people, kind of like myself, who are interested in the technical aspects here and there, but also like the more general stuff and don't have the training, but are happy to listen to the detailed kind of analysis. So, well, thanks so much for coming on. I'm looking forward to checking out the book and the podcast. The name of the podcast, Byzantium and Friends, is that right?
Yes.
Okay, great. Okay, cool. Well, Anthony, it's been great talking to you, and maybe we can talk again one day.
It was a pleasure to be here, and thank you for inviting me. Yeah, anytime you want to do this again, I'm happy to do it.
Awesome. All right. Thank you.